Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on pediatrics.
Hi, welcome guys. I'm Lisa Humphrey from Nationwide Children's. I've gotten the opportunity to meet several of you, most of you. So
I'm here today to talk about children's capacity to understand death and then how they may respond to a death in their family, including themselves, since I am a pediatric practitioner. Okay. And so today what we're going to work on is understanding that there are multiple theories about how someone comes to understand the concept of death. And like all things in developmental psychology, there are theories. In fact, there are multiple theories, right? But most of them come down to two general ideas. This notion that it's cognitively based, right? That notion that you go from being a concrete thinker to an abstract thinker, right? You literally, your neurons get to a place where they can manipulate data differently. Or this notion that it might be task-based, which is the sense that you are forced and otherwise exposed to something and have to grapple with it and sort of work it into your schematas in life, okay? So we're going to spend some time about that, and then we're going to talk about how then, based on one or both of those theories, when you as a palliative care practitioner are asked, well, how do I tell my child is doing this, you know, and this is going to be applicable whether or not you're an adult or a pediatric practitioner, because either there might be a grieved daughter, there may be a grieved sibling, it may be a grieving patient. Okay, so that's our task for today. So it's going to be embedded with a lot of cases. Please feel free to ask questions along the way. And we're going to let the good doctor. Hey, okay, very good. It means I get to pick on you later. No worries. Okay. So these are all true cases. Okay. So this is a 7-year-old. He had refractive and progressive leukemia. He had already gotten 2 bone marrow transplants, not one, but 2. Okay. And both had failed to engraft. And so you could imagine if you've spent, there were lots of machinations and a lot of behind the room talking going on. The parents were very keen on getting a 3rd bone marrow transplant because we had the extra cells, why not? And that was literally how the discussion was happening. And then we get approached by his aunt who says, I don't know what to do with this information. My nephew, the patient, has pulled me aside very purposefully when mom and dad weren't in the room and says, you know, I think I'm going to die. What do you think, Aunt Susie? All right. And she was paralyzed and didn't know how to respond and honestly was absolutely shocked that he knew that this was a concern, which is something you're going to see in pediatrics all the time. But I can imagine it exists on the adult side too, that, you know, the dying parent doesn't think their child, quote unquote, knows anything because I have not sat them down and talked to them about it. So there is no way they understand what's going on. One of the gigantic themes of today will be the children always know, and they tend to know before we give them credit for knowing. Okay? So death conceptualization, as I said a little bit at the beginning, it all based on theories, right? We're never going to have a lab test to know if you understand a concept like death. So the best we can do is try to put some framework around this so that if you're asked of a dying dad or a mother whose, you know, child is dying and they're worrying about their 2-year-old sibling, I want you to be able to say, ah, I at least have a framework to begin this conversation with this parent, okay? And so again, as we talked about, we talk about task-based, that idea that you've been exposed to something, versus stage-based, which is this idea your brain has to develop in order to get to a level of comprehension. So in the stage-based idea of death comprehension, there are 3 things that need to happen, and they have to happen sequentially. You can't go from 1 to 3, you have to go 1, 2, 3, okay? So first is this notion that death, the finality of it, is not understood. So your first stage-based acquisition of death comprehension needs to be you understand it's final. And what I mean by that is a child needs to understand that the heart stops beating, and it's not going to magically start beating again a couple days later, all right? And so it's a lot of the notion of this is not, there's no magic. There's nothing you can do to undo this. It's here to stay. right? And then after that's acquired, the next task is to go on to this notion that it's universal, okay? So a child might say, oh, great Susie, Aunt Susie died. However, it'll never happen to me, right? And then they may say, but Mom, it'll never happen to you. So they don't understand that this is a biological process that happens to all. So that's the next thing that needs to be acquired. And then when they can say all of that, then we say, great, you have gained the notion of what death is, okay? Unescapable, universal, and final. So the sort of partnering but slightly different way of thinking about this is this notion of task-based comprehension of death. And so I will throw my hat out there that I think this one is easier to grapple with, and I think personally, having done this for several years now, this one functionally makes more sense to me because I've seen this happen, and I'll explain a little more what I mean by that. So you again have to gain tasks. You have to understand it's universal, you have to understand it's irreversal, and you have to understand that there's non-functionality to the body, okay? So this notion that a kid will go up to the casket and like ask Aunt Susie to like give her a kiss, right? They may not understand that there's no function anymore associated with death. Okay, so the difference between stage-based versus task-based. Task-based says every time you're moving through your childhood development, so you're 2 and you do this, and then you're 7 and you can do something different, and 12 you do something different. Stage-based would say once you got it, you got it. Okay. Task-based says every time you move into a new development, you need to wrestle again with these ideas, and you learn a greater appreciation, more malleability around the concepts of death. This actually applies to all of childhood development theories that are task-based versus stage-based, okay? So, and what it really requires, right, is like everything else in our lives, when we go from realizing thinking first that all cops are good people, right, they beat up the bad guys and put them in jail, and then you're 12, when you're watching the news and you're like, but Mom, I thought all cops were good, but why is that cop getting arrested by another cop, okay? So you have to accommodate this data, right, to make a new schemata around anything in life, including your understanding of death. And so that becomes important when you're trying to help a parent understand how to help their child who is grieving, because a lot of our parents are going to say, don't worry, I'm going to get them in counseling right now. Actually, it tends to be more the grandparents in my world, right, who are like, my daughter's falling apart because her child is dying, and I could imagine similar grandma swooping in because, you know, her daughter's losing her husband, and like the grandparents are always like, don't worry, I found a counselor, we're going to go take care of this. And I think in their minds, if they can get like a 1 month bolus of death counseling in them, their kids are going to be fine, right? The tricky thing to me, and that's why I like the task-based one more, is imagine a 2-year-old who loses someone important in their life, really important, like the nuclear part of their family. And so they're grieving at 2, and we're going to talk about what that looks like, but can you imagine when you're 7 and everyone's taking pictures of the first day of school in first grade, you're missing someone really important in your picture, right? And you have to wonder why you're different than other, right? And what does it mean? And then you come 16 and you're allowed to drive the car and that important person isn't there. And then you go to college and then you get your first job and then you get married and then you have a kid, right? So you could fathom repetitively someone has to grieve, someone has to understand it, someone has to come up with a new scheme to make sense of the whole thing, okay? Hence why I tend to like the task-based, and I think it's important that we tell that really well-intentioned grandma or parent or aunt or whomever, this is going to be a life process. I appreciate you feeling this urgency to get them into counseling now. A, if Mom's not ready to send her own kid to counseling, it is okay, right? There has to be permission within the household. And B, even if you do it now, my suggestion is find someone you trust, make it a good relationship, make it something that the child sees as positive, because they may need to do this and recapitulate this over time. So it's really important, the entry into mental health counseling. Okay. So, next case. Now we're moving on, okay? So 4-year-old sibling witnesses their, I think it was like a 12-month-old, if I remember correctly, who fell into a bathtub and was drowning. Okay, mom found a little too late. She panics. She calls 911. Understandably, never thinks about the 4-year-old being right next to her through this whole thing. Okay, EMS comes. EMS is performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation, gets the heartbeat back. You know, you can imagine all the drama. They're putting the child in the truck, whisking them off to the hospital. We meet the family a couple days later, and one of mom's biggest concerns was that the 4-year-old, who understandably they had kept at home throughout this whole process to date, was going around to each and every adult they could find asking to play, and every time they played, they were wanting to reenact, and they were literally outplaying the resuscitation. So they would take baby dolls and they were doing CPR to the baby dolls. They were like making statements about like what they overheard the adults saying. Okay, so you know, mom's frozen. Her knee-jerk reaction is, I need to make this stop, because I think she felt like this is just horrifying, right? Like, you shouldn't encourage this child to be doing this. They don't understand what they're talking about, etc. Okay? So when you're 0 to 5 years old, especially if you're closer to 5, that sort of activity is incredibly common, and we need to acknowledge it and validate it. All right. So if you're 0 to 2, you're not doing that yet. You truly have no death conceptualization, okay? That's not to mean to say they don't react to the death, but they don't conceive it. When you get to be about 3 to 5 years old, and please know, of course, these are gigantic clumpings of generalizations, but something to anchor to. So somewhere between 3 and 5, someone can gain understanding of this, like, death equaling an altered state. Okay? But they don't understand all those tasks that we were talking about: universality, irreversibility, and non-functionality. But when you get to be 5 to 9 years old, the next grouping, right, you can understand both the irreversibility and the finality, but you still struggle with that universality, okay? So they really are struggling with, why did this happen to my loved one? And they're going to perseverate and keep asking questions about that, because this, again, it's that idea that they don't understand this happens to everybody one way or another. Okay, and most importantly, if you have nieces or nephews or people or you remember, right, 5 to 9 year olds, oh, how they love magical thinking, right? So they think they can escape death themselves because, again, they don't understand the universality of it. Okay, questions so far? Okay. So case 3. We now have an 11-year-old. We actually got involved on the pediatric side because the child was actually in bereavement counseling, and the counselor was asking for some advice because this child kept bouncing through different medical centers, and they were looking. They knew that what was probably underlying it all, but wanted to pull in the physician who could help navigate this for the family. So, an 11-year-old. Whose own mother had died of stomach cancer. We talk a lot about, you know, you got to inform a child and really let them kind of at a developmentally appropriate level understand what's going on. You don't want to hide things. But there's the flip side, which is just the absolute oversharing that can lead to trauma, right? And so this child had absolutely been over-informed by his family around the time of his mother's death. So what ended up happening, around 4 months after death, he started missing just an immense amount of school and having absolutely terrible abdominal pain that had led him through a series of pediatricians and GI specialists. And really what the grief counselor was trying to get the family to understand, though they were struggling with it, is that this pain was emblematic, right? He was mirroring what his mother had died of. He was convinced this is what he would die of, and that this wasn't actually pathological, because they kept wanting scopes and images and such, and the grief counselor wanted to validate where the child was and have the family do the same to move on in his grieving process. So when you are 10 to 13 years old, you now gain universality. We'll talk a little bit later, but just to kind of toggle it here, know that if someone themselves is going through the process, or even the child whose mother might be dying, they may gain it sooner. You could imagine if you are forced into a task, you may have to acquire the skill earlier than what these broad generalizations suggest, okay? But in general, i.e. board questions, if someone asks when a kid understands death, pretty reasonable to say about 10 years of age, okay? So what happens then is this absolute preoccupation with death, all right? And so then this happens regardless if their own loved one is dying. So there might be a lot of discussions. There might be like awkward dinner time conversations where like a parent's like, oh my gosh, that's not what you talk about. And yet they're like, but yeah, but like I saw the bunny rabbit and he was like stiff in the yard. And you know, why'd that happen? And you know, so very common things. And then parents, of course, freak out thinking their child's going to be like the next serial killer because they're obsessed with the bunny rabbit in the yard, right? True story. We get that sometimes, right? So, but it's not true. I mean, what they're trying to do is in their own sort of where they are developmentally, right? They are task oriented. They are information gatherers and they are processors and they tend to be external processors. Now, if they personally have experienced a death of a close loved one, they struggle with this, and this can quickly lead to guilt, okay? So guilt of having fear that they too could die, knowing now the universality of that. In fact, someday they will die, and they struggle deeply with those emotions. May lead, as in our case example, to psychosomatization, because those feelings need to go somewhere, and if they are not in a place where maybe they're allowed to talk about their feelings, or there's so many they don't know what to do with, we all know it comes out in some forms one way or another, okay? And then they might turn, as I say, a little Spock-like on us, right? And so a reaction formation to the point where they just are like, no, I'm cool, man. Like, it's all good. Like, yep, mom dies just like that bunny rabbit in the yard, okay? Like, ain't no big deal. It happens to everybody. Why should I possibly worry about this? Can I go to school now? Okay. And then, of course, people also think they're raising a serial killer because how can you not be stressed out that your mother just died, okay? So for some ways, in some way, kids can never win, right? We expect them to not understand, not worry too much, but then we, like, stress out if they're not worrying enough, okay? So the ability even get to this universality tends to happen when people, kids, understand the biology, right, of a body and the fact that, yeah, it makes sense that at some point cells stop reproducing, cells start doing things, you know, et cetera. So if they don't gain the biology of it, that's why they don't gain the universality of it. Okay. So now we have a 14-year-old who had end-stage cancer. She had this massive rhabdosarcoma of the cheek. For better or for worse, it went into her brain and not out. So it wasn't like a fungating mass, you know. It actually, other than it looking swollen, you actually didn't see any tumor breaking through the skin. That becomes important because she was this absolutely just beautiful girl. And obviously, I think all my patients are beautiful. But this one was literally like just beautiful in personality and beautiful in like her physical appearance. It is a true story that this girl would come to oncology clinic. People would hear her voice. I am not exaggerating. Doors would fly open from like literally other people's examining rooms. I remember this because I was thinking how unprofessional this was, right? And she'd just be wandering down to her room and everyone would be like, oh, she's here. I mean, this is literally the true story. And I'm like, dang, I'm like meeting a rock star here. So this notion of her personhood was very invested, I think, in this idea that she was just this massive extrovert. People loved her, right? Her physical appearance was important to her. Oddly, so she had this ptosis of her left eye, and she didn't make a big deal of it, right? Like, I never know cognitively where she put that, but it becomes important because I met her because her cancer was progressing, but I was more intimately involved in the moment because we had her on a home enteral regimen. She was still going to school, but her pain got horrible. I can only assume, like, the tumor had busted through some bones somewhere, and we were not doing imaging studies and things like that anymore. It was horrendous. Her father, who was like the stoic man, was calling me on the phone sobbing that his baby was hurting. And so I was like, I got this. Like, you know, I was literally the fellow at the time. And I'm like, I got this, man. I heard there's this thing called PCAs. I'm going to slap a CAD pump on you. You'll be back in school in 2 days. It was utterly rejected by this girl, okay? Because, and I quote, the CAD pump's going to make me look different. She was bald with ptosis. Somehow that didn't matter. But somehow the CAD pump was going to tell everybody she had cancer. Because she was very fearful of not fitting into her social group, okay? Very appropriate. So when you're 13, 18 years old and you're grappling with death, you have full conceptualization of death, and most people, greater than 50-60%, according to Piaget, can move on to this notion of abstract thinking. Please remember, not everybody does, all right? That's actually a higher level thinking. There are people, because of whatever cognitive capacities, will never move from concrete thinking to abstract thinking. Sarah is laughing because we have a family we're working with right now, and it's very clear she's actually 18 and she is incapable of grasping it on an abstract level, her own pending death. And so what ends up happening in the 13, 18-year-old, especially those who can move on to abstract thinking, this idea that I can go outside of my body, think of things in like a much larger scheme of life, I can connect dots, that sort of thing, that aren't on the concrete pathway, they run the risk of really impaired grief, okay, if this happens. They are a very, very vulnerable population, and it doesn't necessarily make sense why I call them out more than other populations. It's because there is direct conflict with what their developmental tasks are at that moment and then what death does to them, okay? So teenagers are supposed to care about social groups, right? That is the time to reject your family and accept other with this exploratory way of defining who you are, right? Many of us have rejected, we explored, frankly, most of us come back to our original themes of our childhood and our family culture, but often there's a rejection. And so the reliance on peers, as in my example, crucially important, okay? And that girl was willing to give up pain control in order for that to beat out on everything else, all right? So they risk that. They also risk fitting in, right? So I, a long time ago, got to run a grief camp with my mom, and we lived in this podunk little town, so no one had ever heard to do this. And we would have a week of elementary school age children who had lost a grandparent or a parent. And, they would run along, and it was a lovely experience. But then the following, after that session was done, we would host an adolescent-specific one. As you can imagine, they all walked in sullen as could be, and they all had their head, they all had headphones and Walkmans, so because that's when it was going down. Thank you. We'd have to sit there and take the earphones off and etc. And what you could tell is that everyone was in their own little universe with this sort of like, nobody gets me and you're not going to get me either. Thank God my mom was slightly smarter than the teenagers. She was a grief counselor. She wasn't just some goody two-shoes doing this. And the fascinating thing was to watch the arc of developments, right? So they went from being these slightly different universe, and then about halfway through the camp, you'd hear them starting to talk to each other, and then it would move to, you'd overhear little tiny little groupings say, oh, that happened to you too? And then it would be, oh, you felt that way too? Yeah, I can't stand it when my soccer team does this garbage because they just don't get it. And by the end, right, it was this absolute blossoming and transformation of adolescence because they got to a place where they're like, I have found my new group, right? Here, I don't stick out. Here, I'm not the kid who's like pathetic and lost his mom, okay? So if you can't provide that in a community, right, or the child is unwilling to go and engage in those things, they run a huge risk of increased risky behaviors, right? Because they might chemically cope, they may test their own theory about how vulnerable they are, their sense of justice is threatened, right? So again, think about, I don't know what your adolescence was like, but you are probably standing up for something, right? And darn it, your parents were wrong, and your teacher was wrong, but you were right. Except for death happens to their family, and death happens to all. And there literally is no justice in that, right? And so you could imagine they really are vulnerable. Okay. Questions so far? I don't go above 18. Sorry. If you're 19, it happens. No, kidding. One could easily, especially in America, where we definitely know that development is a little delayed because of just how our cultures are set up, one could easily argue that that last group falls into 21, 23-year-olds, etc. Okay, we're going to move on now, trying to take the same groupings and say, here's how kids respond. Okay, so we kind of know now what might be the task going on, but let's talk about how they express it and then also what we can do about it. Okay, so again, remember, 0-2, they don't comprehend death, but they feel it. Routines have been broken. The person they love might be absent, either because they themselves are dying, or they are taking care of a dying sibling or a dying loved one. So their routines are disrupted. Honestly, things down to smells, how the peanut butter and jelly sandwich is made. Did they remember to cut off the crust? Then again, I guess I'm a pediatrician. We're not supposed to be giving peanut butter to kids these young, but I did. total digression. Okay, right? And so they're going to still have a response, like a physical, emotional response, but then they lack absolutely every capacity to understand why their body is reacting that way. Okay? So what happens? Like all good two-year-olds, they erupt in tantrums, all right? And the parents, maybe because they just need something to go right, maybe because they're freaking out because they don't even know why the kid's having a tantrum, because I can tell you it is very difficult for me to get a family to connect the dots why the two-year-old might be acting up, okay? I get it. They're in the despair of grief. So it's honestly one of those things I have to call it with great frequency, right? And they may honestly not even be aware that the toddler is having issues. So sometimes you even have to call out, how's your toddler doing? And you get the same response every time. Oh, don't worry, they don't understand a thing. They're with grandma, they're having a great time. It's like, really? Tell me a little more about what's grandma been saying about your 18-month-old at home? And then, you know, it's the, oh, he's not eating anymore, and it's really, bedtime's gotten really disruptive, but don't worry about it, Dr. Humphrey, it's because, you know, he's in a different bed. Well, gosh, you told me grandma lives down the street and he sleeps there all the time, right? So you kind of have to walk them along this path that the toddler, true, does not get what's going on, but feels it. Can I necessarily say, Mom, I know you're grieving, your husband just died, your child is dying, I'd like you now to abort all that and go snuggle with the 18-month-old. It just may not be possible, right? You obviously encourage it, but there's that thin line, too, of asking a bereaved person to put one more thing on their plate or to suggest that somehow they're messing up, right? So be very cautious of that. It is a lovely time to say, hey, you've been talking to me about how so many people are reaching out. It's actually almost overwhelming. You just would wish people would stop sending you another casserole because your freezer's full. You know, hey, have you thought about your sister just really kind of just being the identified person for, you know, Liam, your 18-month-old, okay? You know, encourage them to give a task. Yes, of course, the mother would be better or the father would be better. It may not be functionally possible, right? And it's a lovely thing to task out things to do for people waiting in the wings, okay? And it's really just a lot of getting back into the routine, a lot of physical contact, soothing activities, things like that, as you could imagine, right? But with a really clear understanding why you're doing it today versus any other day with an 18-month-old. So 3- and 4-year-olds, as we all know, you know, someone labeled it the terrible twos, but in fact, 3-year-olds are just absolutely, like, you know, humbling is the best way to describe a 3-year-old, okay? In the best of cases, and then you add grief to it, all right? So very intense and brief responses, right? These are the kids that parents start to begin to worry they're raising a serial killer, because they'll be like, busting up to you, I warn parents they're going to do this at exactly 7 p.m. in aisle E of the grocery store with the loudest toddler voice possible. Mom, why'd dad die, right? And, you know, you're like, geez, right here, right now. And if you don't give a satisfaction response, it's on, right? I asked you, why did dad die? Okay? And so you got to prep them for that, right? And you got to tell them their kid is not the next serial killer, right? And the other thing that totally stresses them out, and again, kids can never win with this group and the next group, it's a Dr. Humphrey, my God, like something's wrong with the kid, right? He came in, asked me why his brother died, and then I start answering. All I say is, it's okay. He pivots around, he goes flying back into the backyard, and he keeps playing with his swing. Like, what is wrong with him, right? They are actually brilliant at grief work. We should learn something from kids, right? Because this whole notion of this vacillating, oscillating grief theory, right? Burp the Tupperware, I ask a question, I have an emotional outburst. Oh gosh, that feels better because it was really hard to keep trapped inside me. I think I'll go back and play now, right? Oh, this feels really good. This is really normal. Oh, God, those feelings are coming back. I'm going to swing back over this way. I'm going to explore them a little more, and back I go, right? It's a brilliant way to grieve. Adults don't do it because, right, we're supposed to wear black, and we're supposed to do this, and we're supposed to be very somber, and we're not supposed to do that. You know, we have so many dressings around how one's supposed to grieve, and then the kid just goes and does it so naturally, right? They're not serial killers, as far as I can tell. Okay? So very intense, brief responses is coming out of them. They're very, very present tense oriented. Developmentally, they have to be, right? And so it's very difficult for them to think about future that, like, you know, when you're talking even about the funeral being in 5 days, they're not going to get that, right? And so they may ask all sorts of questions that totally stress out the family because they have no future tense, and they even struggle with past tense, right? Oh, well, they ask questions repeatedly, right? If anybody has, again, children or siblings or nieces and nephews, you know this about this population. You know, everybody jokes, why is the sky blue? Why is the sky blue? Why is the sky blue? I have no idea, kids, shut up, right? Like, is the eternal parent response to that. So can't really do that around death, right? Probably shouldn't even do it about the sky, but we've all been guilty of it. So developmentally, we got to remind parents or caregivers that it is absolutely developmentally appropriate to be egocentric, right? They are, all of a sudden they realize I got these limbs on the ends of them and they're very powerful, right? All of a sudden they have this thing called speech. They might be able to utter in, like, you know, phrases, if not full sentences. And if I do this, like I demand the cookie, it's amazing. That human just walks over and gives me a cookie if I do it 12 times in a row, right? I am all powerful. Okay, so that is very appropriate, but can clash deeply with our very Americanized sense of how you grieve properly. Okay, and they lack death comprehension, so they're just in a hard way. Okay, so what do? Symbolic play, incredibly important, right? So that, remember the four-year-old trying to act out the CPR and the mother saying this is abnormal? It was brilliant, right? What he was trying to do is play it again. He's trying to physically figure out what he just witnessed, right? So I gave the mom a ton of credit. She brought it up to me because then you connect them with therapists who can actually facilitate that type of play work, okay? Physical play, incredibly important. They can't label their emotions, but man, can they get them out in physical play, right? It'll keep everyone happier if they're allowed to go out to the seesaw. Okay. Tolerate the questions. It's the only way to say it, you know. And the important thing to start arming families with in this age group and the next age group is you don't actually have to keep answering it, right? So parents live in this absolute fear, and I apologize, I should say caregivers, not parents, my apologies. But caregivers live in this absolute fear that Pandora's box is going to be ripped open and that they're going to have to just dwell in Pandora's box every single time the kid asks the question, right? You'll see parents sit down and like try to describe the biology again and et cetera, et cetera. It's okay. I mean, the caregiver is likely grieving as well. There's only so much to have on their plate. A, you know, coming up with a few stock phrases to answer it, as long as we make sure that we're not being dishonest about it, is fine, right? It is also fine to tell a parent, you might need to punt this. You literally may be in a stage of grief that you yourself cannot navigate this. Again, your sister, Aunt Susie, has been waiting in the wings for something to do. This seems you trust her inherently. Let her help you, okay? And then again, that notion of normalizing those bursts, right, is really important. Okay. So I had an 8-month-old with congenital cancer in the PICU. It was just miserable. Like, it was one of those diagnoses. The moment you got it, you knew it was never going to work out well. We tried something for the sake of getting some palliative time. All right. I think it was flu season, right? But so we couldn't get the 3-year-old in, right? But the 3-year-old kept asking and asking and asking to visit. Like, this is the only thing they wanted to do, is see their sweet baby brother. And they'd been waiting 10 months to become a sibling. And then, oh my gosh, baby got whisked away at birth. Like, they've met them maybe once or twice the whole time. And, you know, the parents had tried to do a reasonable job of, like, explaining how, you know, like, the doctors are trying to help where they can help because we couch them not to say fix. And, you know, you try to balance, like, kind of how much medical knowledge you're giving this 3-year-old. So finally, we, like, you know, did things in the hospital and got the 3-year-old at bedside. And then he lost it. Like, here he was, he finally got with the, we had been working weeks to make this happen. He starts sobbing and he's panicked. I mean, he's like frenetic in the room. And it's because he had forgotten his doctor play suit. And he wasn't the doctor, he couldn't fix his brother. And he felt that to the core, okay? 5 to 9 year olds, and that 4 year old was quite precocious, or that 3 year old was quite precocious. So I kind of shove him a little bit in this group because it was a good example. Right, so the 5 year olds are gaining this sense of autonomy, right? They all of a sudden realize, you know, I can play in the front yard by myself, or now I'm in school, I'm away from mom and dad, this is kind of cool, right? They are very much exploring the world outside themselves. They're gaining more sophisticated language, right? So they can start throwing adjectives and adverbs into things and win arguments or that sort of thing, right? They get very concerned about responsibility. Think about it. If you have ever counseled a 5 to 9 year old, you do your homework. There is no question about that. You were either a good student or you were a bad student. And we do that time and time again. That's when the good cop, bad cop thing kind of comes about, right? The world is beautiful because we have these very good cops who put very bad people away. And so it's very binary in that way. Kids this age group, because they so earnestly believe the world is so black and white, right and wrong, that if they happen to tip one day, heaven forbid, they kind of told a slight lie. Yes, they were the one who stole the cookie out of the cookie jar, and then, oh shoot, someone asked me about it. I denied it because I was really scared of not being able to do something in the evening. They're riddled with guilt, though, right? Like, somehow stealing the cookie, they are no longer in the good cop category. They're like the world's next criminal, right? Okay. And then magical thinking is abound, and it's a beautiful thing, right? These are the kids who are, like, having just the best artwork and, like, the best forts at night, right? And think of all the amazing things and how all-powerful you felt at age 8, right? I don't know if you remember. There was a couple Super Bowls ago where there's a kid in the Darth Vader outfit out in the yard or out in the driveway, and he's like going, I don't know what he's doing. He's like throwing his hands up or something, and the garage door goes open. And you see him like, yeah! You know, and I mean, it just went up and down. And the cutest part of the end of the commercial was the dad inside watching, like pushing the garage door opener up and down, right? That sums up magical thinking. It's a beautiful thing. Until you think you're the sibling who killed your other sibling or your parents because you got angry at your parents and said, I wish you'd die. They might be like, I wish you'd go away. And then, oh my gosh, they do. Okay? So it's a very, very vulnerable period for them. Okay? And so remember, they don't have full death comprehension yet either, right? And they're struggling with the biology and thus the causality. So that's why this magical thinking can turn south real fast on them. They also, I mean, if you thought a 3 and a 4 year old were asking questions, so do the 5 and 9 year olds. But now, remember, they're armed with much better verbal skills, right? And they're exploring the world. And so they get very involved in the process of it, which can just drive caregivers crazy. And you have to warn them about that, right? Again, it's very normal, but oh my gosh, is it contagious? Will it happen to me? Why did it happen? One of the accidentally most harmful thing a child can ask, and they don't mean it with intent, but every caregiver feels it intent. Mom, why didn't you save my mom? Why did you not save my brother? Why didn't you make the doctors fix him? Okay. That same theme is going to happen in the next age group. This one's a little more innocent, yet the parents, oh man, to the gut, right? Absolutely to the gut. Their grief responses are more normal. Again, lots of repetitive questions because now they're really trying to get at the nuance of it. Then again, remember, they're the ones who may act like nothing had happened, right? They're the ones who might psychosomaticize. They're the ones who might just, okay, great, you know, the dead bunny died. So did mom. I'd like to go to school now. Okay. So what do we do? And how do we counsel families? And again, I have not made this caveat. Obviously, I should. We are not grief counselors, right? All we're trying to do is sort of give a couple tips in a normal, healthy bereavement status, right? Most things, especially when it is a child experiencing a loss, because of that recapitulation throughout themes, we should be in absolute full support of ongoing mental health counseling services, okay, to help. All right. But, however, you know, we are inevitably asked at a bedside, what do I do now? And so again, it's a theme. Validate their right to grieve, because especially in this culture, we seem to think children don't grieve because, quote unquote, they don't get it. But oh my gosh, we need to validate that. Tolerate the questions again. All right. Now that we start becoming about allowing choices and educating about choices, right? Remember I said that they're in this world of autonomy. They're exploring other in the world around them. So they need to at least be asked if they want information about the upcoming memorial, about the funeral, about traditions, okay? And because it's important for them to become an active agent in that if they want to be. We still need to encourage and allow for physical outlets that are safe, right? It is okay to want to go back to soccer practice. It's not that you didn't care about grandma when she died. You are, again, oscillating in managing your grief in an appropriate way, all right? And so, again, another important thing is returning to normal routines, if at all possible, right? It's not that you're not grieving the loss of someone who died. You're trying to anchor kids to things that they can rely on. So now we move on to the next group. Remember I said there were a lot of things that sort of extend into this next group. One could argue it's a slight artificial separation between the two. But remember, around 9 or 10, they're going to gain full death comprehension. Hence why we separate them out. So in this age group, self-confidence, man, it's totally coming, right? This is my daughter who comes down with an outfit the other day, and I'm just aghast, right? And she's like rocking it. And I'm like, okay, if you say so, right? Wouldn't have worn that in a million years, but owning it. They are still very concrete thinkers. That good cop, bad cop is still absolutely there, all right? But now logical thinking is emerging. So soon there's going to be that adolescent crashing between right and wrong, and I'm going to explore this whole thing of justice, right? We're right before then. So they are absolutely, remember, the Spockian people. So they intellectualize their emotions. They get very judgy, because now the good cop, bad cop means I'm going to start sussing out who's good, who's not good. Mom told me, but I think I'm going to look around and do this one myself, too. They start getting a very binary view of the world, and this leads, and then especially if you're 9 or 10, if you are assaulted with some stressful event like a death, you can easily revert to magical thinking, because it's a fantastic place to be in your imaginary world, right? And again, remember, though, that could put them at equal risk of some very maladaptive approaches to death. As you can tell, it's a theme. They ask now questions, but now very specific questions. This is absolutely the group who asks mom why you didn't fix my sibling, but now there's a twinge of judgment and anger with it, right? You told me the doctors were going to fix my brother. You told me the doctor was going to fix my dad, especially if the parents made promises that everything's going to be okay, right? The kid doesn't mean to be a jerk, but the kid is acting kind of like one, right? And so I think it's reasonable for us as physicians to sort of sniff out how a parent or caregiver's relationship is with the siblings or the child, right? Not to say, hey, did they blame you for the death? But that is not something caregivers are going to offer up by themselves, right? It's hard enough for them to feel like maybe they failed their surviving siblings or their children when their spouse died. They're certainly not going to go tell it to a health team, right? But it is an important thing because we need to normalize it, right? And help them find resources, help their child find a better way to grieve. Okay, they want all the details. They're also really, really into looking around the room. Remember, they're interested in other. Looking around the room and saying, should I grieve like that person? Should I grieve like that person? Maybe both, maybe neither, you know, but they're really trying to see how others are responding. This becomes incredibly important, right? When there's forced silence by families who refuse to talk about the death, right? Who try to act perky. You know, the mother who tells me, I don't want to cry in front of my 9-year-old. I don't want him to see me as frail. And you have to say, he needs to. This is important. This is a natural response you're having to a horrible event. You are validating this and giving thereby permission to your 9-year-old to do the same, if that's what his body's telling him to do in that moment, okay? So I can't tell you the number of people who want to put this dressing around death that it's going to all be fine, because they're so terrified that their 9-year-old is going to be sad, right? And that the 9-year-old doesn't get it. you can't keep the 9-year-old from being sad, right? We have no magical powers. And the 9-year-old probably gets it because developmentally he's ready to get it, and task-wise he was forced to get it, okay? And then the 9 and 12-year-olds really start embracing the rituals of mourning. So going to a funeral, having memorial services, that all starts becoming really meaningful to them. All right, so what do? We answer questions honestly. Give the kid the credit, that task-based approach. He or she has been forced to really get this, so now it's time to get real with the answers. But we also have to be careful to listen, right? So now around this age group, and I know I do it all the time with my 11-year-old, right? She's chatting. I just want to clamp it down. Let me give you a summary statement, kid. I got dinner to make, right? On my good days, I listen. On my not so good days, not so much, right? And that's about something simple, like what happened at school that day, versus now you want to do this about a death. All right. So we need to encourage emotions, right? That's that sussing out of what other people are going through, and you need to validate. There is no right way to grieve, but we need to validate that people do in their own ways. Very important to explain choices in terms of memory making, funerals, etc. We also, especially when you get up to around 12, they're tweeny, and they may need space amongst themselves. They have not necessarily rejected the family unit yet in that adolescent, I must go out and explore, but boy, are they on the cusp of it, right? And so we need to give them some space as they naturally are getting towards that part of their development. And again, they still need physical outlets. There's also a theme, right? And I bring up the themes of questioning, and I bring up the themes of physical outlets because people don't want to be answering questions because of that Pandora box fear, and they also might think, what would the neighbors think if I let my kid keep going to soccer practice, right? And because we have to remember, as we sit there in the hospital, and in a lot of large centers like this, or academic centers, like where a lot of us are at, this is all like we are more okay with death than a lot of places. If you go back to your small communities, you go back to a faith community, they may have very prescribed ways that people are supposed to grieve, right? And it's not unheard of that people will start getting snarky with a caregiver who is bereaved themselves about how they're letting their child show grief work. So we have to be able to validate it as physicians and nurse practitioners that, yes, we think this is appropriate and healthy for the child. Okay. Now on to the teenagers, okay? Remember, abstract thinking, rejection, and they're trying to in and out integrate other ideas into their personality. They might regress too, right? All of a sudden, your very brilliant 15-year-old who had it together is starting to throw tantrums again, and you're like, what is going on? Haven't been in this spot for 10 years. Very, very dependent on peer support, as we've talked about, and we'll talk a little more about that. There is evidence that in about 1 year after the death of someone important in their life, teenagers will increase their risk-taking behavior, be it sex, especially unprotected sex, drinking, substance use disorders, reckless driving, etc. For most, that dissipates and they go back to the norm of their adolescent peers in about 1 year. Some do not and continue, and obviously red flag behavior, that's another talk, but you often can see red flag behavior at other events happening, okay? And those are people we're needing to pull off quicker and get to more intensive counseling. They also more likely embrace very traditional mourning, okay? They may wear the black, they may grieve in more traditional ways, coming up with similar phraseology that we might use, etc. They absolutely tend to reject one-on-one counseling, as you can imagine. That's kind of universal for teenagers in general. They tend to do better with group counseling, group death, as in like the camp that I discussed. They absolutely do not like being in a group counseling experience where they have to deal with the 65-year-old who's also grieving, right? Like, that's not their normed group. They need to be with another at least 10-year-old, right? So this notion of children, a grieving child or a grieving adolescent group, much more effective. Unfortunately, some of our communities are not going to be able to offer that, right? And that's when you wonder, can you help encourage your health system? Because again, we all work in systems where unfortunately there are going to be fathers and mothers or children dying. All right. Athletics is a huge thing, as are other groups like drama and music. Again, it's this idea, one, it's physical outlet still, but for all the different groups, it is a way to meet that need of being around peers, and it's a way of highlighting other aspects of that kid's personality, okay? So they're not just the kid who lost his dad. He's the kid who happens to be in drama club who happens to have lost his dad, right? So they can norm around the other aspects of their character. And while it may not be direct counseling, it is still very supportive to them through the process. All right? And so that's why all those different activities exist on there. Okay. You will be asked on your boards this whole notion about whether or not we allow a child to go to a funeral. The answer is yes, if you have asked them. Okay? So we can't force them to go, and we should not keep them from going without having a conversation with them, is really the end result of that discussion. Okay? So what the real goal is children being able to define themselves and define where they are, and then they themselves coming up with meaningful contributions to the whole ritual of saying goodbye to those we love. Please remember, too, children do not come onto this earth fearful of death, right? They don't even get it. We teach them to be scared of death, right? And we know that because we're working with their parents and everything else. But it is a real opportunity to kind of call that out to family members. That notion of, I want to protect my son, he's not going to the funeral. Well, you may have just created a terrifying experience for the 7-year-old who's wondering what in God's green earth happened to my brother's body or my father's body. So, other vignette. So I told you how there were two groups of camps that we ran for the school age kids. About the latter half of the camp experience, we actually took them on a field trip to a funeral home. You can imagine the parents were freaking out because we had to get permission slips to put them on the bus, and we always had at least 20% of the parents who would absolutely refuse, and all of them would be like storming the office asking us why you would possibly do this. It only got worse when we got there because we had this fantastic funeral director who'd let the kids literally play in the caskets. And so the kids loved it. I'm not kidding. They're putting themselves inside the body. Their new friends are closing the lids. I'm sort of running after them, opening the lids again, wondering how much oxygen content's in there. The parents are literally universally in the corner at that point going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And my mom is literally, like, standing in the corner with them saying, like, you know, like she's like her own version of a sports announcer, right? It was serious. She's like, oh, look at Billy. I haven't seen him smile all week. That's amazing. And look at Susie, right? Those kids came back from the funeral, and they like met the embalmer, and they met the makeup artist, and they got to see the hearse, and they got in the hearse, and so, right? Like, those kids came back jazzed, right? Like they, and again, the parents, most of them got to a spot where they're like, who the funk it, right? We had demystified the whole experience, right? We have to remember this was a while ago where we were even less likely to let a kid go to the funeral. So when we don't allow permission to be part of that, and you just, it's kind of like those parents who tell the 2-year-old, you know, he went to the hospital, he never came back, right? Jiminy Crickets, would you ever want to enter a hospital? Because it seems like a really bad spot to be in because the boogeyman takes you in the hospital. Okay? So we got to norm it, if at all possible. Okay? Including them in this, right? It validates the child and where they're at. And that is inherently important. We have to remember that they are still a person, still with feelings, still trying to wrestle with this death comprehension. Okay? So I already gave you the answer to the last one. You let a kid go. You let them go at any age. You let them make decisions about it. And if they go, you know, prep them. Right? You got to prep them. You got to arm with knowledge that's developmentally appropriate, you know? Mom's going to be tearful. It is going to be okay, right? It's sad and it's hard, but that's important to mommy that she's tearful. You're allowed to be tearful too, right? No, you're probably not going to be able to be in mommy's arms during this period of time. Don't worry, grandma's going to hold you, all right? So prep them. And then, you know, if they want it, and if they do, you know, ask them what they want to contribute. Do they want to write a poem, right? Often kids will go around and they'll pick out their sibling's favorite shirt, or they'll pick out daddy's whatever. They may want to put it in a casket, right? Something important to them. They may want to take something and hold on to it during the funeral. So a lot of prep work needs to go into it. I would absolutely encourage families to identify the adult who's going to be sort of that kid's caregiver, there are multiple siblings going, I would encourage that there's literally one adult per one grieving kid. All right? And it is okay if they don't want to go. And that can get particularly difficult, again, in smaller, tighter communities where there is a right way to show your respects and the wrong way to show the respects. And we have to arm families that the heck with them. They're not in your shoes. They're not going through your experience. You know your kid best. This is important. If they've been asked and the kid has said no. I think it's still important, maybe that day, maybe a different day, still offering and encouraging some sort of keepsaking memorial work, right? In their own way, a kid still needs to start making some sort of legacy and a way of remembering the person that they've lost. Okay, questions so far? Now on to the easy stuff. So say the kid, him or herself, is dying. What do we do? Okay. Mercifully for most of you, this will not be your bread and butter, but you never know. Okay. So what do we need to know about kids when they are faced with their own mortality? So again, all that death understanding we've been talking about is still applicable here. How they grieve, again, what we just discussed, still applicable here, along with how they cope. Family culture becomes incredibly important, right? All that stuff you heard on Tuesday about family dynamics and the role of the child, it is absolutely just smack gob in the middle of this whole conversation, right? So remember the very first one. The kid knew to ask the aunt and not his own parents if he was going to die. I targeted the person who was going to tell him the truth and not get upset with him, nor was he going to upset her as much as he might upset his mom or dad. Okay, so we got to think about all those family dynamics and just honor them where they're at, because it may not be the right counseling. And I did not tell the aunt to go in there and just break it all down for the family, because she knew and I knew, having worked for this family for a while, that that was not going to be in this kid's best interest to just crack this thing wide open. Instead, we had to sort of start planning how to broach with the family that their own child is asking this question. Okay, and then, you know, we have to think too about the child's rights within the family. Is he allowed to even agree to the third transplant, right? Or is he, more importantly, allowed to disagree to a third transplant if he wanted to? And is he in any way, shape, or form allowed to voice his personal goals? And that's not only if you are 10. You know, I had a 20-year-old who had cancer, and his mother, God love her, she is a fantastic and incredibly intense human being. She absolutely insisted he go first to our hospital. When that didn't work, he went to NIH, and when that didn't work, he went down to MD Anderson, and he met every single oncology research program in the country, right? And he came back to me, and he was on fire. He was in again for some palliative chemo. He's like swearing at the nurses and like yelling at the docs, and I went in with my flak jacket and didn't know it was coming my way, except for I was his legalized drug dealer, because I gave him his opioids, so he had to be a little nice to me. And I do call myself that, right? And then for whatever reason, maybe because I was the one who started bringing up advanced care planning, right? It didn't happen that day, but within a couple weeks, months, he's talking to me about, he has known since he was diagnosed he was going to die, but his mother literally will not allow him to give up, and he's gotten to a place that he's just like, she needs this. I'm still going to die. The heck with if I'm going to have some pain. The heck with if I can't stand being trapped in the kids' hospital. She needs this more than me. I have no voice at this table right now. It is what it is. Okay? So that's a gigantic part. And I don't want to overstep my clinical skills, but I have to think that it even happens when like young adults, 30s and 40-year-olds, are dying and the family is insisting that they continue on. Okay? So there's a couple terms to know, right, when we think about how a kid understands their own mortality, right? This notion of assent, with the stuff I just talked about, right? We also, you know, we've talked a lot about how task-based and the importance of that, and it may force things along in understanding sooner than later, right? That all falls under this notion of precocious maturation. and I apologize if I've talked to you guys about this before, but it's a really important concept to understand. You know, that 9-year-old talking to his aunt was just breaking it down. He was saying things like, I've been through 2 bone marrow transplants. They caused me pain. I don't know why anyone would give me a third. Don't they understand? This is not working, right? And you're like, holy crud, we got to like take this kid and we got to just plop him in front of his parents. He's got to say exactly that. And the whole, you know, everyone will agree not to give him a third transplant. The problem is, this tends to be the same kid or fill in the blank with another kid. About 2 minutes later, they're saying that, I don't know what ridiculous thing. You know, if Spider-Man could only be present, everything would be fine. And you're like, and no one's going to believe you that you actually know what's going on, right? Because they have gained maturation precociously in one arena of their life, particularly their own health status, and they do not have equal developmental skills in other areas of comprehension, okay? We have to be very thoughtful about role assignation in the family. We touched on that the other day, that idea that I'm the sick child, and what does that mean to my mother? What do I do if I erode her relationship with me? How risky is it? That 21-year-old talking to me about his mother, making him go over the country. She was fantastic. She is still fantastic. He knew, and I couldn't disagree with her, she was going to fall apart, like hardcore fall apart, primary breadwinner of the family. Like, it was just going to be a disaster if like he stood up to her and said no. So he just did it. And then the last notion, especially if you're starting to talk about capacity and autonomy and all those ethics things, it's a reasonable article about how if someone is dying in their 17, do they have the same burden to prove capacity and understanding as someone who is 18 or 17, sorry, and not sick, not going to die, and refusing a treatment, okay? Because the kid's probably going to die in 6 months. Does he really need to understand the ramifications of a theoretical risk that could happen 2 years from now? Does that make sense, right? So he just has to have enough understanding for the 6 months he has left. Okay, and then, so these happen, right? Ascent, less than 18 years of age, this notion of emerging autonomy before you're 18, and then full autonomy when you're 18 years and older, if competent. Okay, so right, for the sake of time, I apologize. I'm going to move on because we've mostly talked about this case, right? This is sort of that classic, what do you do with all that autonomy and such, or capacity to understand despite your age? Okay, so I had a really difficult case. It was a 15-year-old. She also had terminal rhabdosarcoma. We are running a special during my fellowship. And hers was in the abdomen, and it was horrendous. I mean, she looked beyond 10 months pregnant. I mean, it was just absolutely horrendous, the burden of her abdomen. And we would do all the typical things, trying to tap it, trying to tamponade it. Like, it was just horrible. She's puking as a result of the pressure, etc. You know, we are very frank with the family, feeling like it was sort of obvious. Her belly was growing by the day. This was terminal. She was dying. The family wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. They took her out of the hospital, which was fine, except for didn't invoke her hospice benefit. Instead, like, had some personal finances, literally flew her to Mexico for some experimental therapy. It was horrible. She came back in a fixed-wing plane, transport plane from Mexico in Florida DIC. Like, it was just, she was like literally bleeding from orifices, and she was pale, and the belly was now, I couldn't even believe it could get bigger. It was now bigger because there was belly blood in her abdomen. You know, so now the parents are horribly broken, and you feel horrible when they get in that spot, and they were like, yes, we recognize she's going to die. Okay, we're not asking for any more intervention, but their new care plan was, you will not say palliative care, you will not say hospice, you will not say that she's dying. None of those are to be stated around her, and I'm like looking at the badge being like, well, this is awkward, and so they're like, you have to take your badge off. Like, you are not allowed to go in there if you do not take your badge off. And so I walk in feeling really awkward, right? And being like, hi. And she's just mute. She said nothing. Like, honestly, for a week, she said nothing to me. And I'm a fellow. This is horrible. She's trapped in the hospital on the oncology floor. No one's giving her any chemo, right? I mean, you can imagine where my brain was. She's saying nothing, right? So what do you do? A couple odd things happened. One was, remember my girl, the social butterfly? Ooh, she's here. All right. They literally were in the dying process at the exact same time. Okay. It was quite an exciting fellowship couple of months there. So she has a completely different story happening. So her parents hear that her cancer is worsening. Okay, thank you very much. We'd like her home. She needs to get to school. That's important to her. I want her near her friends. Her younger brother is her world. This is all nuts. We're going home. They asked me to come to the home. It's the most awkward thing I've ever walked into. Rookie mistake. Didn't bring an attending with me. They have literally an entire buffet laid out. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm here to talk about death and they want me to eat a turkey sandwich. Okay, so eat my turkey sandwich and we're sitting down. And literally they're like we all sit down and she's across from me and the parents go, so-and-so, you may now proceed. Like, literally, I'll never forget them saying that. She's like, oh, great. What's it like to die? And I was like, oh, God, right? Like, didn't see that one coming, right? So these two things are happening in my life at the same exact time, and I'm wrestling with, like, you know, why can't this other family be like this family? And gosh, I hope I answered that question correctly. I found out way too late in the ballgame. They were desperately good friends with each other. Unbeknownst to any parent, they were on the phone every night for about 2 or 3 hours. So the girl who was silent was talking to this girl every single night, and they were openly talking about, like, death. Okay? And the most beautiful, the only denouement I can have over this story, one, this girl, and to the end of time, was just the most beautiful thing in the world. She used her Make-A-Wish to make a game room for her brother in the basement. Of course she did, because he was worried he wouldn't have someone to play with after she died, right? She had a very peaceful death at home. The other girl, one day, you know, you're doing the whole winter thing, and you're putting the gown on, you can't find the gloves, and, you know, I promise I wasn't stalking for the sake of stalking, and I literally hear her go, Daddy. Daddy, it's okay. And he's in there, and you kind of peek through the stalker windows, and he's like crying, and she's like, you've been a good daddy. It's okay. You have to let me die, right? So I'd like to think this girl and the girl herself had given themselves the courage for her to have that conversation. And finally, I was allowed in the room, right? Like, earnestly allowed in the room, right? So sometimes the point of that story is you never know who your friends are going to be to help you through it. It might be your respiratory therapist, right? You never know with kids who they're going to anoint as the chosen one to have this conversation. And they do. My God, how teenagers in particular, they wait and they wait and they wait for their moment to tell their parent, okay? And you gotta have faith that they're gonna do it at their own pace, and that's artificially forcing it is not gonna help. Okay. Last case, I think. All right, so had a 16-year-old who was an actively practicing Jehovah Witness. So, of course, they do not agree. They feel it is a sin to receive the blood of another. So had longstanding been cared for at our hospital for his medulloblastoma because we were a blood-conserving hospital, and so they had sought us out actively. And his tumor had returned, surgery was offered, but location. We were very concerned there could be significant bleeding that would not have been amenable to our blood-conserving protocols. So we had started to pursue, as we do for all patients less than 18, we go through a court order. We do that because the long-standing notion has been, while the adults have full capacity and understanding around choosing this faith and not taking blood transfusions, we don't say that the child has, and so to protect the child's inherent rights, it's one of the few times we'll actually circumvent a parent decision making and go to the courts. Okay? You have to understand that this started getting never tensious, but just sort of activity filled. Because the other thing often about the Jehovah faith, witness faith, is that there's a council of elders effectively, and if there is a medical conundrum or a spiritual conundrum, members of the church are offered and sometimes expected to go to the elders, right, and discuss and get advice from them about what the right thing to do is. And we will often even get members coming to the bedside, talking to the physicians with permission, trying to say, please don't give a blood transfusion or something, okay? So we thought this was typical, but the difference being, right, this is now kind of a palliative surgery. We certainly knew we could prolong his life, but with the significant risk of bleeding that we thought was manageable with blood products, okay? So we go and get that. And then he himself, independent of any elder in the room or an adult in the room, he asks for medical emancipation, knew the exact words to say. He wanted the right to refuse surgery because of the transfusion risk. Yeah.
How long did it take to...
Breaking the rules.
How long did it take to get the court order?
Oh, we can, honestly, we can do it in hours.
Oh, wow.
Because of the fact that often, especially in kids, it might be an emergent process. We're whisking you to the OR. So it's a pretty set pathway. It's not just our hospital. Pretty much all pediatric caregivers have a local set pathway with their courts. Yeah. We weren't working under a pressure of hours. You know, it was sort of in days to weeks. We wanted to get him into the operating room closer to days. So we get the court order. We think this is fine. We walk in the room saying, great, we have a court order. And he just starts refusing and says he wants medical emancipation. Our first knee-jerk reaction is, who put you up to that? Right? I mean, to be really honest, right? It was very fancy language for a 16-year-old. And, you know, we're doing our typical thing. We're so very sorry. Like, you know, you're not 18. This is what we do when you're 18. And he very thoughtfully was like, I'm 16. I've been battling this for years. I know the risks. I recognize I will die as a result of this. I'm probably going to die no matter what happens. You might buy me 2 years, but in the process of it, you're going to make me commit a sin, receive a blood transfusion, and then I will not get to heaven. So I'm in an absolute moral spiritual crisis over this. Therefore, I am asking for the right to medically emancipate myself so that you do not honor the court order. Okay? So that was a fun day for me. You know, really what we did is we got legal involved, we got our ethics committee involved. We actually had several people interview him independently. We actually met with the elders to have a better understanding, honestly, of like what this all meant. And obviously no one forced a physician to agree to it or not, but actually all the physicians in turn actually gained support for it. We granted him medical emancipation. We did not do the surgery. He lived for about another couple months, and then he died. But, you know, very peaceful death throughout it all, just an absolutely beautiful faith that this was the right choice. He understood the ramifications of his medical choices. Okay? So, summary statements, and then we'll take some questions if you have them. Right? Death understanding happens over time due to both cognitive growth and experience. You know, maybe either or, probably both. Grief is developmentally based, and it recapitulates, right? That if there's nothing else you remember, right? When you're going to your first day of school, you're going to grieve. When you are getting your first driver's license, you will grieve, right? Those big moments in life, and frankly, maybe even the smaller ones. Okay? And then we need to allow a child to have a voice, discuss it at their own pace, and also just meet them at the road where they're at. Okay? Thanks, everybody. Questions, ideas. I think I'm supposed to show all these. Okay. Wow, I'm just that good of a teacher. Zero questions. Either that or that bad of a teacher. Okay. Thanks, guys. Oh, yeah.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the wonderful talk. So, I didn't grow up with Mr. Rogers, but because of the movie, I've been looking at
all disciples, right?
Yeah. And, you know, He used to advocate, when a child asks you something, answer honestly. And he used to say things like, when bad things happen, tell the child, I'm here to protect you. But what happens if, in the case, for example, where a sibling is asking, will I die too? Mm-hmm. Can this happen to me? What do you recommend? Because the Mr. Rogers answer is, well, tell the child, as a parent or the caregiver, I am here to protect you. I'm not going to let anything bad happen to you. But, you know, you have to put that caveat. As long, you know, as much as I can. How do you answer those tough questions? And when parents ask you that, what do you tell them?
I don't know if I have a perfect answer for that because every child's different, right? So part of it is knowing potentially the sibling, or more often than not, I know the parent at least, and how I think they may respond to the question or answer it, and maybe what's driving them to ask me the question. I agree with Mr. Rogers. I'd be very fascinated if he would say the same thing if in exactly the same situation, right? Because you can't actually promise a child you're going to keep them safe.
Yeah.
And so I would tell them, don't promise that in this situation, right? I think it's about I promise to love you. I promise you that you are not sick right now. I promise you that if you ever got sick, that the doctors would do everything they can to help you, right? What you're trying to do is reinforce the people in their lives will always do the best things they can, I think is the best shot we have, right? I think it's important, if they're of age, to just acknowledge that universality of death, right? Because that may be the very kernel that the kid's struggling with and trying to understand. You don't want to do it when they're 4, but if they're 7 or 8, they may precociously start getting, oh my gosh, this can happen to everyone, therefore it may happen to me. Part of the biggest things to, you know, counsel and have families do, I would say easily up to 12 years and maybe even older, is before they reflexively answer any question, recognize, have a family member recognize, before you answer it, do a teach back or reflect back, I hear you saying, right, so that, because there is a high risk that an adult's going to hear a child's question through the lens of the stuff they worry most about, right? Oh my God, they're asking the question, right? And they start talking about death, and the kid's like, whoa, like I was just kind of asking because I kind of wonder when this was wrapping up because they wanted dinner, right? So we need to be real careful, our lens, right? And that's, you meet kids better in the road that way. You might be able to quickly figure out they're asking about universality or they're not.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.